Welcome back to College Golf Talk. Brentley Romine here, and missing this week is Steve Burkowski. He is currently in Dubai. You can catch him on the call for this week's Asia Pacific Amateur. I believe that's on ESPN. Starts today, Thursday. And hopefully Burko will be back and has shaken off the jet lag in time to record next week. But in the meantime, I figured since things are blowing up with the rankings and fall season's winding down, it's the perfect time to bring in two people who cover the college game as close as anybody, Cameron Jordan from Golf Week and the godfather of college golf, Golf Week's Lance Ringler. Guys, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Glad to be on. Thanks for the invite, and excited to talk some college golf.
Always fun to be with you, Brentley.
And Lance, for those who cannot see, he has his Christmas tree up. Lance, do you want to explain why your Christmas tree is up? It's October 23rd.
It's a holiday tree, and it gets changed out every whatever the holiday is coming up. That's what my wife Missy likes to do.
So, what's the theme in May?
I think it's Indy 500.
We could put tires on it, or?
But well, little race cars. But you know what, Brentley? You know what we could put on there? NGI.
You could put NGI, NCAA, Omni La Costa, swag from the gift shop.
NCAA is in March. March Madness.
No, but not the NCAA Golf Championship.
Oh, I'm talking basketball, yeah. No, NGI in May.
Well, you also, this month, instead of Halloween, you could commemorate the very first top 10 national Division I ranking for UMass Amherst. So that's just a round of applause for UMass Amherst, top 10 ranking, short-lived though. That has now since slipped to 249 or something like that.
Well, how can they even be ranked? They're not Division I team.
Cameron dove into this, and they're actually a club team, Cameron, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, they're a club team, but to my knowledge, if you have to be eligible for the NCAA championship to be able to be ranked in the rankings. So I have absolutely no idea. They do play a Division I schedule. They are playing in Division I tournaments, but other club teams do the same.
The fact that we're even having this discussion is insane. They are a club team. They should not be anywhere included in any NCAA Division I, Division II, Division III ranking whatsoever. Period.
Well, we will definitely dive into the rankings discussion a little bit later in the pod, so stay tuned for that. But in the meantime, let's dive into the results. Let's start with the men, the Fallen Oak Collegiate. This is played, I believe it's in, is it Saucier, Mississippi, something like that, at a casino. LSU gets the job done, their third win of the season. Arnie Svensson, the Ice King, or the Ice Prince, maybe. Wins individually, his second career individual title. I believe Alabama also tied for the team title as well, so we don't want to give Jay Sewell and the boys, we don't want to slight them. But gentlemen, I guess we'll start with Cameron. LSU, three wins. Are they currently maybe the front runners to win the NCAA title?
I mean, I don't know how you say they can. It's a team that last year became, what, the only sixth number one seed to not advance out of regionals. And the way that they've started this year, I mean, you got to give credit to Jake Amos and his team. They've played outstanding golf to start this year. They're playing with a little bit of a chip on their shoulder, it looks like, too. And like you said, Arnie has just picked up another really big win, and he beat William Jennings, which you wrote about William earlier this year. He has a great story. In the spring, he shot 90 in an individual tournament, and now he has a couple of wins this year, and now a T2 in this event. But yeah, the LSU team is just playing really, really well. And if you're looking at the top teams and who's played the best in the fall, I think there's a couple teams that stand out, and LSU maybe the one that's at the top of the list.
Yeah, it was actually a 92 for William Jennings, so you don't want to shortchange him there. And on his way to shooting a second straight 90 in that tournament in the spring at Watersound before Jay Sewell pulled maybe one of the ultimate coaching moves and took the scorecard out of his hand on the 18th hole so that he couldn't sign for a second straight 90. But what a turnaround, probably the front runner for the comeback player of the year award, which Lance, if we had to name the comeback player of the year award after somebody in the history of college golf, what would, I'll let you stew on that for a little bit as I kind of talk about as I talk about the rest of this leaderboard, brainstorm that. But Illinois was third. Arkansas is a team, Cameron, that you didn't have in your preseason top 25. I had them 14th. I was all over the Razorbacks. Camden Smith, his best finish as a Razorback after transferring from Georgia. They're a sneaky team to watch out for. And then Ole Miss in fifth there. Michael Asasso, T18, continues to struggle this fall relatively. Obviously, there's several players in college golf that would kill for, you know, the number of top 20, top 15 finishes that Michael Asasso has had this fall. But a team, I think, that is still trying maybe to find a little bit of its identity, especially toward the back end of that lineup. But maybe once they can get Michael Asasso playing full-time college golf again, they can develop some sort of rhythm. Lance, any ideas? Comeback Player of the Year award?
No, that would take a little bit of research. I mean, we have to figure out what the criteria would be, but that would be a good one. I'm sure there's been some players out there that have fought through some heavy adversity and then come back and had an outstanding like senior year. We'd have to do some research on that one.
I mean, we could name it after Lance Ringler.
No, not after me.
Have you had any comebacks in your career?
I've had a good comeback this summer. I struggled on the golf course early on, and I've been playing pretty well lately. So this year's been a good comeback year for me.
Does the season that Arkansas has had so far, has that surprised you, Lance, at all? I know you're fairly close with Brad McMakin.
Well, I haven't talked to Brad this spring or this fall, but yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, they kind of, you know, for, I mean, going back, what, I don't know, early part of his career at Arkansas, they were talked about a lot, got a lot of attention, and it just kind of been quiet the last few years. And obviously, you know, with John Daly the second being there, it's garnered some interest and some talk. But yeah, I mean, Brad's an intense person, and you know, he's a big competitor. I mean, he did a great job when he was at Lamar, had a really good couple years before he went to Arkansas. So no, it doesn't surprise me. It may be more surprising that we just haven't talked about him as much the last few years, but whenever you got a great competitor who wants to win and got resources, you know, you never be surprised when they perk up.
It's pretty impressive too. John Daly, the throwout score in two of those three rounds as well. So getting it done in other places. Now let's, head to Wilmington, North Carolina, Eagle Point, one of the great clubs on the East Coast. Have always wanted to go there. But the Williams Cup, this is a tournament that I think has continued to get better field-wise since it debuted, gosh, maybe 6 or 7 years ago now. Maybe it hasn't been quite that long. But Florida, the team that we all kind of thought they'd be, finally show up. They dropped a few shots late. It could have been one of those runaway victories that we'll talk about here pretty soon. But the Florida Gators get it done over Texas. Zach Swanwick was in line to get his first college win, but goes double on 17, bogey on 18. Nate Stevens gets the job done for his first college win for Notre Dame. John Handrigan continues to do a great job. They get a nice 1-2 punch there with Jacob Mudleski at the top. But I want to talk a little bit about Florida. And maybe a bit of a depth discussion. I've kind of had this theory that depth isn't all created equal. You either have depth in which you have maybe a strong number one guy, a first team All-American, and then your depth is kind of 3 through 8. I think this Florida team has a unique depth in that maybe 1 through 6 or maybe 1 through 4 is all kind of interchangeable, and then 5 through 9 is all interchangeable. I'll kind of lead the floor open to either of you guys if you want to take this. Do you think that Florida's depth, the way that it currently looks, do you think it could be kind of a curse maybe as well, just as JC Deacon tries to figure out who's going to be in his lineup?
I mean, I can start this one, Lance. I think it's interesting if you look at who played in their lineup. They didn't even have Noah Kent, the 2024 U.S. Amateur runner-up, in the lineup. I mean, that just kind of shows how deep this Florida team is. I mean, it's a credit to JC and to Dudley Hart and what they've done to build up the program. There can be some negative sides to depth because they left a couple of really good players at home. Also, Parker Sands not in the lineup for this Williams Cup, but
Josh Bai as well.
Yeah, and when you look at,
although I think he's in Asia, he might be at the Asia Pacific.
Correct, and then when you look at who else played though, You have Luke Poulter, who's preseason All-American, and you have, like you said, Zach Swanwick wasn't a great position to get his first win. Doesn't come through. You have Jack Turner, Matthew Kress, Parker Bell. They're all players who have experience for this Florida team. And it's just sometimes you have to figure out who's going to be playing the best down the stretch. I know we said that Florida struggled to close out a 12-shot win, which is crazy to say that. But, I think that the competitive depth can be a really good thing, and it can make those top five. I mean, that's what they're trying to find out, is who's going to be the five best players come SECs, come regionals, and come the national championship. And that's essentially what the regular season is for. So I think the depth can be a good thing too. But if you're looking for a possible side effect, are one of these kids going to want to hop in the portal after the year if they kind of find themselves outside these top five or six? So that's just part of the conversation in college golf in 2025. But I think overall competition and depth is a good thing.
Yeah. Lance, at what point in the spring because you've coached college golf, your wife, Missy, coached college golf. At what point in the spring do you want to have your five set and throw qualifying out the window?
Yeah, great question. It's a good problem that coaches have, but it's also you have to have some experience in how to deal and manage with the chemistry of a team. You want to have your five guys or even your sub nowadays with that being a part of postseason. You want to have it set in advance to where everyone's comfortable. But you always hear coaches talking about, you know, how they want their players being pushed. And when you have that competitive depth that Cameron mentioned, that pushes all the players to remain, you know, they got to stay sharp. They got to stay focused because they want to stay in the lineup. But, it's a good problem to have, but it also can create problems. And if you don't have a coaching staff that knows how to deal with it and mature kids, it can definitely cause drama in that team van come later in the spring. And then like Cameron said, now with the portal, you know, these kids, you know, they don't feel like they're getting the playing time they need. They're out. So it's an interesting scenario, and I think it's managed differently amongst different programs.
Yeah, I still think it was maybe a little bit of a curious decision, just in terms of Noah Kent to transfer from Iowa, a place where he was the number one guy unquestioned. And I realize Florida plays, you know, better schedule and in terms of PGA Tour U, but you don't get any PGA Tour U points if you're on the bench. So hopefully Noah Kent, for his sake, can get into that lineup and start showing, you know, the type of player that we know he can be and that we saw at Cherry Hills a couple of summers ago. I want to touch on Zach Swanwick just really quickly. Really cool story on how he came to Gainesville. He had sent JC a message at some point after they could communicate with college coaches on WhatsApp, and JC didn't see it for a few months and finally saw it, looked at the scores, and it's like, all right, I'm going to fly out to New Zealand. I'm going to watch you play. And right before he left, there was a cyclone that hit Zach's hometown in New Zealand, and there was a mudslide. And his golf clubs were at the golf course, and the golf course ended up under mud. So he didn't have his golf clubs. JC is like, well, do you want me to reschedule? I could do that. And Zach's like, no, I'm going to play. So with rental clubs, borrowed clubs, whatever, he went out there, probably shot a few under, something like that. And JC saw all he needed to see, texted Dudley Hart, the assistant, and it's like, we got our guy. So just kind of a tough, gritty kid. I've been waiting for him to kind of break out this fall. He's been in and out of the lineup. You know, obviously that's another byproduct of depth, someone like that not making it, but finally seeing kind of the fruits of his labor. Luke Potter for Texas plays at an individual. He seems like he's back in the swing of things, solo sixth. I always find it strange, guys. Christian Moss can look so great at the World Amateur Team Championship, in which he's playing a different golf course than everyone, and then you show up a few days later and you tie for 43rd in a college golf event. That's always kind of stands out as something that's just head scratching. Further down the leaderboard, I'm going to ask you guys which team you're most concerned about. Oklahoma tied for 7th. Jace Summey continues to not look 100%. T43 for him individually. And then Auburn, solo 9th. Jackson Koivin, from what I heard, boots on the ground. The driver is continuing to give him fits. T10 for him, which We expect him to win each and every time. Only one other Auburn Tiger in the top 50 in terms of the players who are in the starting lineup. So, Lance, you go first. Oklahoma or Auburn, who are you pressing the panic button before the other?
Man, that's a good question.
They're all good questions.
You know,
that's a good question.
Oklahoma,
there, Lance.
Oklahoma has always been a team that we've always kind of labeled a blue collar squad, a group that's, you know, not afraid to get in the trenches and work hard. And that's kind of a reflection of their head coach, Ryan Hibble.
Don't they have the highest paid head coach in college golf? They're blue collar still.
Yeah. I don't know if they, yeah, I don't know. If, I think Mike Small
what's their NIL endowment.
I think Mike Small might have him clipped in the salary, but I see where you're going with that. But I don't know. In Auburn, I would say I would be more concerned myself if we had to push a panic button. It would probably be on Auburn a little bit if I had to pick one way or the other. But I also, you know, great players, good coaches, good history, good tradition. Those programs will probably be okay. Again, remember, it's all about top eight after 72, right? So you don't have to be the best. You just got to get in position to get there.
Auburn was ninth, though, in this tournament. Cameron, I think I know where you're going with this.
I'm gonna go Auburn on this one. Just
too
Gilbert,
close to Norman. The folks in Norman, we know how crazy they can be. I think Brentley Romine Tracker will come after you if you said Auburn or Oklahoma.
Okay. Gotta watch out for Brentley Romine Tracker and the GCAA coming up to my house. I think it's got to be Auburn. Josiah Gilbert won his first event this year and since then has gone 48th and 60th. And, you know, after losing Brendan Valdez last year, and you really thought that Josiah was going to kind of step up and be the, if we're going to call Batman is comparing him to Jackson Koivin, then Robin is going to be Josiah. And he just kind of hasn't had that consistency this year. Obviously we see he can win, but being able to be a top 15, 10, 15 player every single week and finishing strong for Auburn. I mean, they need him to play well. Caden Pope had a T22, which is a decent finish. I mean, you're never going to complain about someone like that. But then also Billy Davis is T56. Logan Riley, their freshman, T56. They just need a little bit more from those guys. And you know, it's a couple people and they're having some players who haven't been in the lineup. So you're still having to find some camaraderie. And kind of like Lance said, the whole goal at the end is to just get in the top eight. I mean, Auburn won what, 10 tournaments 2 years ago when they won the national title. And I think they finished, I forget what they finished after stroke play, but all you have to do is get in, all you have to do is get into the match play. And so kind of similar to the whole Florida thing, you have plenty of tournaments throughout the year to try to get things figured out for these guys. But there's definitely some concerns with Auburn with how some players and just the kind of inconsistency that they've had. That's definitely something that they're going to want to work on as the spring comes around.
So if Josiah Gilbert not looking like Robin right now, maybe looking a little bit more like Mr. Freeze. Other men's results, just rapid fire. Memphis, they rally to edge Florida Gulf Coast at Quail Valley Collegiate, the event put on by Paul McGinley. It was great to see him out there kind of brushing elbows with college golf. The Eagles were without their best player, Nolan Harper, because of illness. So a good performance both by the Tigers and Coach Andrew Dana's squad, putting together good final rounds there. Keeping it in the state, Central Florida, Stetson, the Hatters, they edge Campbell by a shot at the Furman Intercollegiate, Arkansas State by four over host St. Mary's at their event out in California. And then the Golden Flash individual. We normally don't highlight individual events unless it is the Put Me In Coach Invitational, one of Lance Ringler's creations or part creations. Were you involved in creating that, Lance? I always forget. Or was that more of a Mike Fleck?
No. That was me. That was my. Obviously, I co-host it with Ball State and Coach Fleck, but he let me. I came up with the name and the
you
whole
didn't.
Deal
you weren't there though.
Yeah, I was.
You were?
Yeah, I've been there both years.
You were in Florida.
No, tournament director. I'm there.
All right. Well, anyways, Golden Flash individual. And the reason that it's in here is because it is at the Country Club of Hudson, which, as we know now, is the home, new home of Steve Burkowski, Adam Buchanan, shot 3 under in 36 holes to win by one. He is from Louisville. Did not touch Burko's course record of 61, which was fired never. But anyways, moving on to the women's side of things, we'll start with probably biggest.
I'm confused, Brantley. Burkowski shot 61. You're confusing me here.
No, I said that shot never.
Oh, the 61 okay.
that was Burko recorded
shot 61 and we don't know about this. Okay, never mind.
Well, 61 for 9 holes probably. he's on the complete opposite side of the globe. We can right. throw shots at Burko all we want, but women's results: Stanford Intercollegiate at Stanford Golf Club on campus, one of the, in my opinion, no offense to the folks at Stanford, one of the worst first tee shots in golf, where you're hitting over the power lines. I think they're still there. I don't think they've buried the power lines there yet. But great field, great event. Do a lot of good raising money for breast cancer research and awareness. And that continued to be the case this year. I don't have a final number, but I know they bring in a lot of money for that. So really cool deal that Ann Walker does there. Stanford wins big, wins in a quote-unquote runaway. That was not considered a runaway by the rankings gods. But no doubt, Mega Gane wins individually, one of four Stanford players in the top eight, I believe. That kind of mirrors what kind of where they stand in the world amateur golf ranking. Stanford didn't win the Stevens Cup, but I would assume, Cameron, not surprised by the performance that they put together at home.
Not surprised at all. Like you said, it's what Ann Walker has built out there and what they have coming in. I mean, we're not going to talk about down the road, but they have the number one women's commit in the class of 2026, the number top two in 2027. So even with a couple of players who are going to be leaving the next couple of years, like they're losing Mega Gane, U.S. Women's Am champ. Oh, well, we're going to replace her with the number one recruit in the country. It's just what a outstanding job she's done of recruiting and then allowing these girls to flourish. I can't even imagine the competition that they have when they're having qualifying. Real quick too, not to take away from Stanford, obviously 21 shot win is impressive. The individual leaderboard at this tournament was outstanding. You had finishing a shot behind Mega Gane was world number one, Kiara Romero, her Mega's teammate, Paula Martin, San Pedro, Catherine Park from USC. Kathy's had a really strong fall. Go down the list. You have Patient Rhodes at Arizona State. Meha Ortsengren, another Stanford player, T8. Farrow Key from Texas. Freshman Madison Mesmer at Tennessee. Kelly Hsu from Stanford. Nora Sunburn. Jasmine Koo. I mean, the top of this leaderboard is just filled with a lot of the best names in women's college golf. I mean, it truly was an incredible individual tournament. If you want to look at that, that was a really fun leaderboard to watch as it came down the stretch.
Also, Ariana Lau from Northwestern, one of the best freshmen in the country, T20. Northwestern, though, down in T12. You mentioned Kathy Park. Something crazy, like 8 runner-up finishes now in her college career. She's a senior, 4 wins as well. But, a player that has had to be leaned on just a little bit more with Bailey Shoemaker on the shelf. Recently had a little bit of a procedure done. She's going to be out a few weeks. Hasn't played at all this fall. But, you know, when you bring in someone like Sarah Hammett, Kylie Chong coming off a great summer in what she won the SEC, the SCGA amateur, not the Cal State, one of those, either the Cal State or the SCGA. Won those, but a little bit further down the leaderboard, and we'll go to Lance.
Let me say something.
You have a comment?
Yeah. So, Cameron, what you're telling me is the great players that Stanford has and they're coming in, the next 4 or 5 NCAA championships, they're probably only going to win 1 or 2 of them, right?
if you look at history, they've won stroke play 5 straight years and only had 2 national titles
That's the problem. I mean, you're the best team all year long, you know, by a landslide, and then it's flipped that coin. Anyway.
Lance, I think it only guarantees one thing, that they won't be competing in the NGI the next 4 years.
You're correct about that. You're correct. But probably if they did play in the NGI, they'd probably win.
Now for a team that is perhaps maybe a little bit closer to playing in the NGI, Texas, tied for 9th, where they were without Cindy Hsu, who was playing in the second stage of LPGA Q School, did not get through, so she will not have the decision to make in terms of deferring Epson status or turning pro. There were, I believe, five current college players who did get through second stage. I don't have the list in front of me right now, but maybe I'll look that up when I, you know, have a breather when one of you guys are talking. But I think T9, though, still in this field, when you finish behind Colorado, Iowa State, UCLA, all good teams, but certainly not at the level of Texas. I still think you could probably chalk this one up as a pretty disappointing showing for Laura Iannello's Longhorns. But perhaps the most disappointing team on the women's side this fall is all the way down there in T15, the LSU Tigers. They're ranked 35th now in Mark Brody's all and powerful scoreboard national collegiate team rankings. Forgot to probably add a few words in there, golf maybe. But Tigers have not been good. Rocia Tejedo has struggled. She's been in and out the lineup. I think she's played one time so far this fall, maybe two. Are we worried about LSU, Cameron or Lance?
I mean, how can you say no? I mean, it's a very similar thing to Auburn. And on the men's side, this is a team that has a lot of talent. I really thought Francesca Fiorellini coming over from UCLA in the offseason, I thought that was one of the biggest transfers on the women's side. Actually set a record.
She's probably
at the golf
been
week.
Their best player. Like, yeah, she's probably been their best player too.
Yeah, set a record at the Golf Week Red Sky Classic. Little selfish brag there. Lance was at that tournament, shot 63.
Well, Lance set up the golf course. So yeah, 63 is more.
Out in Colorado, and thought that she was going to have a really big year. And like you said, she has been the best player, but T37 for her, Taylor Riley, who's a player who's been in and out of the lineup for Garrett Runyon, T30, best finish. But then you look at the rest of the lineup, you have 60, T60, T83, and then a 97th. So not quite sure. Like you said, Rocio Tejedo not being in the lineup is really hurts them. They need her to be able to have success. But it is a little bit surprising to see them struggle the way they have early in the year.
Now we'll spin through some more women's results since we're already at approaching the 30-minute mark. The Alley in West Point, Mississippi, Florida Gators, their third straight win in that event, their second straight of the fall. When you talk about depth, this is another team that's kind of built like their male counterparts. Maybe not with a top, you know, 10 amateur in the world, but certainly a great player in Paula Francisco, and just a lot of depth, you know, good players being left at home as well. Megan Propet continues to play well after transferring from Virginia. They win by 5 shots over Arkansas, which was second despite having Abby Shute, who was the medalist, Reagan Zabilski, who was second, and Maria Jose Marin, who was T3. That's kind of hard to do, but I guess the positive for the folks in Fayetteville is that you do have three players finishing in the top three. Elizabeth Rudisill from Vanderbilt, she was leading after 36 holes, shoots two over. The standout freshman will have to wait for her first college golf victory. I don't think she's had one yet. Could be wrong, but if not, she will have to wait. And then the Ruth Chris Tar Heel Invitational. Auburn getting back on track. That vaulted them into the top 10 in the team rankings. Anna Davis, her fourth career win. Wake Forest, ninth. Another kind of disappointing finish of the week, along with LSU, is Wake Forest, who was number one. They beat Stanford at the Stevens Cup in stroke play and match play. Is there enough there, Lance, when you consider that they all the players they've lost over the years, the first team All-Americans, the Rachel Keens, the Carol Shakaras from last year? Rachel was obviously 2 years ago. But is there enough, you think, for Wake Forest to, I guess we can project all the way to late May, is there enough there for them to beat a Stanford in match play?
Well, of course. I mean, I think they're in match play. You talk about match play, it dummies it down. So it gives teams with lesser talent a chance to win. So again, a team like Wake Forest, obviously they got a lot of confidence. The coach has been there, done that. Yeah, there's no reason to think that if they can get themselves into position, they could draw on all their past experiences, and they're still good players. So yeah, there's certainly enough there.
Yeah, and think of it this way, Brentley. Stanford has lost three times in match play in the last six-ish months, and two of those have been to Wake Forest. So it can happen.
It's all based on matchup too, right? You got to make sure that if you're Kim and Ryan, you kind of protect your best players, you know, Chloe Kovaleski, Macy Pate, like those are their two horses at the top, just in terms of experience, match play, medal, all that. So it'll come down to that theater style room at the Omni La Costa with the worm salad in the back row and and Lance up front with his cell phone filming the coaches taking their sweet time. Jim West Challenge, a little bit of news out of this one. Texas A&M, they shoot 13 under on the final day, bypass Florida State. Good performance there by Amy Bond's squad, who is in rebuild / reload mode this year. We'll see them next week at the East Lake Cup. Houston's Natalie St. Germain, one of the more unheralded players. Houston's got a pretty good lineup as it in and of itself. She wins individually. Vanessa Borovios from A&M, her second top three of the fall. But the big news out of this is the player who was not here and will no longer be here, and that's Aggies freshman Scarlett Schremmer. Cameron, you broke this news. Tell us a little bit about Scarlett Schremmer and moving on.
Yeah, you know, she was the number two recruit in the 2025 class and is no longer with the Aggies. She played in their opener at Carmel Cup and finished T23, also played at the MB3 match play and went 2-1. And then just decided to leave the team. And talking with Coach Chadwell, you know, I think it's just something that was kind of it's going to be a mutually beneficial thing for both parties at the end of the day. I don't think it's anything that you obviously want to happen. You don't want a top player like that to have to go. But I think for Scarlett, I just don't think it was working out the best. I think she's going to try to work on her own game. Not quite sure yet if she's going to enter the transfer portal and look to play collegiately somewhere else, or just kind of focus and play amateur events and eventually try to turn pro. She was not a part of the LPGA Q series and trying to qualify. So she's still going to be an amateur for some more time. And then for Texas A&M, like we said, it's their third win of the fall. It's a team that is really looking really, really stout, but they also had the number two overall recruiting class as well, with three other really talented freshmen who are still there and making an impact. So I think this is something that down the road is going to be mutually beneficial for both parties. Perhaps Scarlett will want to tell her story a little bit more, but she said she's just going to focus on her academics right now and just try to focus on growing her game and the time being as well.
So if they were the number two recruiting class this past year, who was number one?
I think Duke, Rhianne Malixie and Avery McCreary.
Yeah, that's true. When you have the top ranked player and another first team Rolex junior, I guess I could see that. But Bryn Court, Natalie Yen have both been very, very good so far in their college career. A lot of PR speak, I think, surrounding this, Cameron.
May have
heard through the grapevine that perhaps this was more of a team decision, maybe not so much a mutual decision, but you know, certainly wish the luck to Scarlett Schremmer. She did commit to three schools as a high schooler: Miami, Texas, then Texas A&M. So perhaps you know there will be some schools wanting a very talented player if she chooses to get into the portal. I know a lot of people will be after her because she, as we've seen at Augusta National, a really great player with a bright future. Quickly, women's results elsewhere, the Rambo Wahine and Hawaii Baylor. Jay Goble and his squad get it done by 9 over Santa Clara. Yurang Lee from the Bears won by 6. That would be, I think, Lance, that would be a runaway 6-shot individual.
Yeah. How high is the guardrail?
The bumpers, it's kind of like bowling, you know, when it's your turn and the bumpers pop up, that's when you know things are getting a little out of hand. Jasmine Leoval, another great finish, runner-up for the Brew Crew, Eastern Michigan Eagles. Boston College wins in a runaway by 18 at Diamante. UNCG defends their home turf by 5 over UNC Asheville. Ross Cash's squad putting together a really nice season so far. I know Cameron and I have both documented their story over the last 12 months or so since the that area and that university was impacted by the hurricane last fall. And then Kansas State by a whopping 27. The Brody bumpers are definitely popping up for this one as they beat Cincinnati at the Power Cat Invitational. We're going to go ahead and put the Brody bumper alert onto that one. So that's our results. I think for those who have may have been wondering what runaway, what Brody bumpers are, let's dive into the rankings. Let's start with Lance, since you seem to be the most passionate about it. Why is everyone up in arms on this lovely Thursday in October?
Well, I think the biggest thing to talk about first is the fact that people just don't know. They did not know there was any changes. Well, they don't understand it a lot.
Cameron
to begin
knew.
With.
Cameron did know.
Cameron did know. Cameron talked to him, wrote a story on it. But I think a lot of people just didn't realize. Well, they didn't know that there was a change that was made. I mean, they said that I think Brody said to Cameron that the coaches voted on it. I'll let Cameron tell the change in a second.
Yeah, Cameron. Let's explain
okay,
the changes.
Start with Cameron. Yeah.
So only for the Division I women and not the men, and this happens in other divisions too. I don't know exactly who the bumper's in place for, but they changed a rule that if a team or player has too big of a runaway victory, what defines a runaway victory? I don't have that definition. I don't know if anybody has that definition. That's Mark Brody who has that definition. But if a team wins by too big of a margin or a large margin, there's going to be a somewhat of a handicap placed on how many points they can actually get from that win. What that handicap is, again, I don't know. I don't know if it's going to vary depending on how big you win, on how small you win. It's honestly, it's a little bit of math that's kind of confused even people who do rankings on their own. I know we all follow college golf really closely, and it's even hard for us to try to figure out what the rankings are going to be and how they work. So I think that that's something that shouldn't be the case. I think it's very obvious that the rankings in year three, we should all understand exactly how they work, and we still don't. And that's not right.
And that's the biggest problem, Brentley, is people did not know this change was coming, or I guess some people did, but certainly not the masses. I don't think this applies to the individual rankings. I think this just applies to the team rankings, which is odd too. So I don't know. I mean, it's just, we're in year three now, and you know, I've been critical on a few things, and one of those being the start date. And I think part of the problem is, if we would have had rankings in mid-September, it would have had time to work itself out. People would have seen how things are changing in progression. But the problem is we come out with rankings when some teams are completely done with their fall. Most teams only have one event left. So they only get to see one updated ranking to see one movement within the rankings. So now we go into the winter break completely confused, not understanding the changes or the movement. And then I constantly get asked, why is this important, Lance? It's important because it's what determines the postseason field. It's what determines awards. But another thing that's important about it is schools set their schedules a year in advance, sometimes a year and a half, 2 years in advance with some of these programs and where they're going to go. And they try to pick places and go to tournaments and play against fields based on what they know about the rankings, and they don't know what to do. So they're just to me, and I think when you talk to coaches, it's a pretty big problem still.
I think Cameron's acting as the podcast stenographer as he types away and makes everyone think that their wheel is falling off of their car. This was kind of a crazy update that I learned about yesterday. Kudos to Cameron for talking to the professor and getting ahead of things. But I think the biggest question is, like, what constitutes a runaway? Because looking at the results, it would seem that the only school this fall, and I could be corrected if I'm wrong, have put out this question on Twitter and no one's answered it. But what constitutes a runaway and what doesn't? Because Arkansas, which is the team that missed out on roughly 60 points from their win at the Blessings, which we've known over the last couple of years that the Blessings has been kind of a cheat code for the Razorbacks, because it's a very difficult, different golf course that if it's your home course, like, that it's just the ultimate separator. And but anyways, they win by 36. They miss out on roughly 60 points. But Stanford won by 21. USC won your event, Lance, the Red Sky Classic, by 17. Texas A&M won by 26 at Pebble Beach to start the fall. All of those teams, except for Arkansas, received normal points. And then at the right. Blessings, the runner-up team received normal points. So this would seem basically like Arkansas is getting picked on a little bit. And right. I don't see why someone should have the power to arbitrarily basically say, because what they're saying is, Arkansas, we don't think you're this good. Therefore, you must be penalized. Like, it is completely ridiculous. And luckily, Lance, you and I, Cameron as well, we know people who can predict these rankings, who have figured out Brody's formula and can say that instead of being ranked 8th in the country, Arkansas women should be ranked 3rd in the country right now, behind Stanford and USC, I believe. So to me, this is just – now, I heard that because this was a committee decision, and I heard that the subject of Arkansas and the Blessings has been a hot-button topic within the committee the last couple years. The coaches think they get too many points, which if you think about it, like they earned them because they just absolutely kicked the living crap out of the sixth or seventh place team.
If people are worried about it, don't go play in the event.
Correct.
It's pretty simple. I mean, quit this. It's all nonsense. You're 3 years into this and you can't be changing ranking systems the way the ranking system works every year. You just can't do that. I mean, speaking from my history with Jeff Sagarin and doing the Golf Week Sagarin rankings, when they came out in 1999 to 2000, all the way to 2 years ago, never changed one character in the formula. Nothing. It was never changed. You can't be changing it. These coaches, you know, they want this, they want that. You know, they got to follow the criteria of what's supposed to be how the rankings are put forth. And for the, well, that, maybe not the history, but at least the last 30 years, modern day college golf, it was always built on head-to-head competition and stroke differential. And now it's, you guys can help me if you understand this better than me maybe, but now it's based on how much you beat the average score of the field by, the strokes gained. I mean,
yeah, your event strokes gain number includes the strength of field as well. So that number, you can kind of predict you know, how many points. So basically,
who
I think
Arkansas
was like 3.51 or something like that, and so that should have been, you know, 130 something points or
right.
You know,
well, what coaches voted for that? Who wanted strokes gained as part of the formula to rank college golf? I mean, I don't know. It's we can go down exit 34 on this one and talk about it forever. But yeah,
go ahead, Cameron. You wanted to say something?
No, I kind of just reiterating a point that I just had too. I think the biggest thing is that if you have one person who's arbitrarily saying, okay, we're going to take points away from this event, but we're not going to take points away from this event. Like, why doesn't Texas A&M for a 26 shot win? Anybody would agree that's a runaway win. It's a great win. It's a pretty good field out at Pebble Beach. How do they not get penalized for that the same way Arkansas did at the Blessings? You can't just pick and choose what teams. There has to be a set of parameters, and possibly there is, but it hasn't been published, so it's not very transparent. That's the thing. There's not a lot of – the whole point of switching rankings was the coaches – what they said is they wanted more transparency. The NCAA, that's what they've gone behind. They said they wanted more transparency for everything, and now it's even more cloudy and more confusing as to how the rankings have come about. And that's just not okay. It's just not.
Well, so do we think, and this might be more of a question for Lance, but let's just say a runaway, what constitutes a runaway victory is 28 shots. And let's say you're winning by 28 shots and your last player is on 18. Do you have them bogey the last hole? So that you only win by 27 and the bumpers don't fly up and you know, down the lane? Well,
I don't know. You would think that the points are going to increase no matter how high you go up. But this reminds me of college football back when Roy Kramer and the SEC came up with the college football playoffs or the system. And I think they capped scoring winning margin by 28 points. Like once you beat a team by 28 or more, it kind of stayed the same. And I get it in another sport like, you know, football, basketball, where you coaches can control the margin of victory to a point. Like, you know, they can lay down or they can not punch it in or put the second string in, things like that. But in golf, people don't get up to the last hole and pump one out of bounds just to keep it close, or they don't make eagles just to, you know, win by more. So golf is a true sport in terms of score, difference in score. And capping victories is crazy. I mean, if you're that good, you're that good. And if it's a home course, great. Big deal. Like I said, don't go play in the event. Know your schedule and where you're going to go play. And this is just really odd. And it's really odd to me that it's for men, for women's team, but nothing else. It just makes it very hard to understand for people. And I don't know. I think this needs to be talked about more.
Yeah, to me, this might be, and I've kind of, the rankings have kind of grown on me just a little bit, just in terms of when you look at them in May, things seem to make at least, you know, a decent amount of sense, more so on the team side than the individual side. But for me, this change might be one of the dumbest things that I've ever seen. It seems like it was completely geared toward Arkansas and the perception that they were getting inflated points, you know, inaccurately over the last 2 years. The fact that they get 78 points for demolishing probably a better field than at the Red Sky Classic, Lance, at least in terms of the event strokes gained, and USC got over 40 points more for winning by fewer shots as well. So something that should absolutely be a talking point, maybe even an argument at the coaching convention, ask the members of the committee. I believe Kalen Anderson is the top coach on that. Maybe ask why Arkansas is being picked on, because is just when ridiculous.
When you look at the individual points for those events, you know, the points, the difference is astronomical. I mean, Avery Weed, she's got 223 points. In third place is 69 points. Then you go look at the points for the Red Sky Classic, where the Southern Cal ladies got like 75 points. 220. I mean, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Well, with that said, we will move on before Lance's blood pressure and mine, for that matter, get any higher. Let's move on to some Division II, Division III golf. Let's start with Division III, the Chick-fil-A Invitational. Sewanee, Neil Phillips did something pretty cool in that he not only made a hole-in-one with his first swing of the day on the par 3 eighth at Stonebridge Country Club in Rome, Georgia, but he did it again on the same hole to start his second round later that afternoon. I would have to think that this is the first example of two hole-in-ones on the same hole in the same tournament day. Pretty stout stuff, pretty unbelievable stuff for Neil Phillips, and not just a pitch and putt hole either. 182 yards, 7-iron in the afternoon, 6-iron before that, and 45 degree weather in the morning. Cameron, is this the craziest thing you've seen in golf, or has something topped that, Lance, you could follow as well?
It's pretty incredible. I mean, talk about 36 hole day. It's such a long stretch of day. Starting on a par three, honestly, starting on a par three stinks. I mean, even just doing that as a recreational golfer and like fun, like if you're in a scramble or something, it stinks. You usually want to hit a longer club, but you have to hit an iron. I mean, some people may like it. I'm not that good of a golfer, so maybe these college guys and college golfers really like it. But starting on a par three, step up there, hit it in. What a way to start a round. You're going to have some pretty good vibes coming back to the hole, but it's 6 hours later, completely different conditions. He took a 7-iron in the afternoon compared to a 6-iron in the morning. Yeah. Still puts it in there. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. It's truly astounding.
Yeah. Here's the one thing that's even more astounding about this is he hit a different club. I mean, if I aced the hole in the morning with my 7-iron, I'm thinking, okay, it looks like a 7-iron again, right? But he different club. So that's even crazier to me.
Well, Lance, there's this thing called physics. And when it's about 20 degrees warmer, the ball will fly a little bit further.
But there's also this thing called superstition and vibe. And I'm probably going to hit the same club, right? Same yardage, same hole. So that's crazy, though.
Do we think that he used a broken tee?
He might have.
Probably the craziest thing golf wise on a golf course. The craziest story is still, and you know, we'll use this as a moment to congratulate among the three entries into the GCAA Coaching Hall of Fame. Trey Jones from Florida State shared this story a couple years ago, but the Hootie at Bulls Bay event, they used to have a bull named Titleist that they would chain to a tree off of the 18th green, and it was kind of the mascot for the event. And one year, Titleist broke free and started running around during the tournament, and they had to corral him. Probably that's got to be probably the craziest thing that's ever happened on the golf course. And with that, we'll switch to Division II now. Lance, do you want to take the floor and just explain how this Fripp Island to Bermuda PGA Tour exemption came to be and who won it?
Yeah, I mean, just a really, really cool event. We just hosted at Fripp Island. Lee University, we had a really strong field. I think six or seven of the top 10 teams in the country were there. Strong field, a lot of the best players. And the winning player, we secured an exemption to the Butterfield Bermuda Championship. So the winning player was going to get a spot in that field, which no one ever remembers that ever happening at the Division II level. So it's happened, obviously, at the Division I level, both on men and women's side. But to have an exemption into a PGA Tour event for D2 golf, it really circled around the Division II community. And really exciting tournament. The back nine was fun to watch. I think when they made the turn, there were six players within three shots of the lead. So it was pretty tight coming down the stretch. And Lee University, which is ranked the number two team in the country, had its top two players, Drew Zielinski and Bennett McNabb, going head-to-head before Drew birdied his last three holes. And you want it to be like that. You don't want somebody to make a double bogey and the other person win. And to see him make three birdies and get that spot in Bermuda here in 3 weeks was a lot of fun. And Cameron was there covering the whole thing, so he can talk about it as well. But it's just a really cool thing. And hats off to Danielle Carrera, the tournament director at the Butterfield, for giving us that exemption. And really cool. And if all things go well, hopefully we can do it again next year.
Well, I'm glad to see that the Auto King, Zielinski Auto Parts, will be making his PGA Tour debut. Very sad, though, that Charles's great-grandson, Harry Dickens, did not win that event. It could have been the best of times, but instead it was the worst of times for young Harry. Now let's kind of – actually, you know what? This is something that I meant to touch on around Ruth Chris, and we obviously had the Chick-fil-A Invitational as well. I wanted to get, and well, since Lance, you've been doing this for 40 years or so, the best golf course tournament food, because apparently I was told, and this is why our pal Marcus L was attending the Ruth Chris North Carolina's home event at UNC Findlay, to try to get some free food, but there was a reason, because everyone on site, players, parents, spectators, coaches, they get free filet sliders, all this food from Ruth Chris. It sounds like an awesome time. I'm sure the Chick-fil-A Invitational had free Chick-fil-A. What's the best tournament food in college golf?
Well, obviously that's pretty good. I could tell you of two events that I know of. Rhode Island used to host an event. The late Tom Drennan, they used to host an event. And you can ask any coach that's been there. They used to put out a seafood spread that was as good as anything, I'm sure, in college golf ever and in the future. It was something that if you talk to people about it, they just said that the amount of seafood and the quality was top notch for sure. So that event no longer is played, and I can't remember the exact name of the event, but Rhode Island hosted it. And the other one was the Western Refining Sun Bowl All-American Classic. I had the privilege of attending that several times, and we used to go, I can't even remember the names. The Sheriff's Posse was, I think, the name of the group, and they had this little ranch, and they had steaks that had been, I don't know, sitting in a shed aging for like 60 days. They were the best steaks I've ever had anywhere, anytime. And everyone there would say the same thing. And that dinner was as good as it got. So those two jump right out. I know a third one probably when they roll up the In-N-Out truck at, out in California.
Yeah.
Southern Cal's event, I believe, was probably pretty
Pepperdine's good. Pepperdine's event as well has the In-N-Out truck.
Yeah. So those three come to mind, you know, from my travels.
Cameron, can you believe that Lance left out his all-time favorite college golf dessert?
Well, I'm shocked. That's not part of the tournament. That's just in where the tournament's at.
So what is that, Lance?
Shout out to Montauk Seafood and Grill and the number one dessert in the world, sand pie.
In Vail, Colorado. In the Village.
Vail, Colorado.
Cameron.
In the Village.
I know you're probably going to... Wait, do what?
Cameron's not... Brentley, you've had it.
Yeah, I've had the sand pie.
Cameron has not. Cameron, we got to get there.
I have had a watermelon slushy, though.
These watermelon slushies.
I mean, the watermelon slushies are got to be up there. Cameron, I know you're not going to go with the great spread at the Omni La Costa, our lunch meats and worm salads, but what have you found on your journeys over the last few years?
This is probably going to be cheating because it's not a college event. But you and I experienced this together only a couple months ago. The best golf course food I've ever had. It's the Burger Dog.
Oh,
at Olympic Club.
Burger Dog.
But it's with grilled onions. And they didn't do that during US Amateur Week, but we got to have it with grilled onions when we were there for Media Day. And it was the best golf course snack I've ever had.
I bought the molds for the Burger Dogs. I made them at home on my griddle. They were not as good as the Burger Dogs at Bill's in the middle of Olympic Club.
You can perfect them.
You bought them. What do they sell molds for this?
Yeah, there? I mean the mold was a little ridiculous. It was like $20, and you know, when you can just kind of do it yourself. But you know, it's just kind of the whole experience. Getting to say that you have the mold from Bill's Burgers and can make the actual Burger Dog in the exact same size. I still don't know how much you're actually supposed to smash it down when you put it on the Blackstone, but we'll perfect it. It's not a huge hit with the rest of the family, but I did it right. I thought it was pretty close, but definitely not as good. I would say that the best college golf spread that I've ever had is another defunct tournament, but the Isleworth Collegiate Invitational used to have the best food, hands down. I know, you know, Florida and Illinois and Alabama, all these coaches there from Mike Small to JC Deacon would agree that Isleworth, some pretty great food. Who knows what they're going to give us at Omni La Costa next year. Hopefully it's, you know, it's a little bit of hot food.
They probably already have the sardines sitting out next to the salad.
Hey, the sardines, I think one of them walked away when sardines only swim. So, I mean, you do the math on that. Yeah. But another great spread is the great folks at Eastlake for the Eastlake Cup. This is not a transition. They actually do have an amazing spread. There's the Tom Cousins Award dinner, too, on Saturday night. Food's pretty good there as well. But Eastlake Cup, the fall is winding down. It can only mean one thing, that the Eastlake Cup, this kind of sounds like an ad read, but I swear it's not an ad read. But the Eastlake Cup, it kind of signals the end of the college golf fall semester. On the women's side, Stanford is not in the field again. I think I don't remember the last time that they have played, but it almost feels like they're protesting at this point. But Stanford is not in the field, but Northwestern, the team that beat them, is, along with USC, Oregon, and Florida State. So the two more semifinalists, and then USC, who was the highest finisher in stroke play that made match play. And then on the men's side, a really good field as well, with Virginia, the national runners-up, Florida, ASU, and Ole Miss. So some great individuals like Ben James, Michael Lissasso, Connor Williams from Arizona State. Oklahoma State not playing. They were playing the Clerico in Tulsa. I know that kudos to Alan Bratton for actually giving us a phone call, and he was really apologetic. And I tried to tell him that you could field two teams like Georgia Tech did a couple years ago. Remember when they sent the one team to Eastlake and then the other team went to Cypress Point, and among that that lineup was the backup quarterback, or a walk-on quarterback, I believe, that got to play Cypress Point for his first and only college golf tournament. So that's kind of a cool story. Knowing the teams that are playing, Cameron, who are your picks to win the East Lake Cup? And then what do you think is the biggest storyline? I know Lance probably doesn't think there's any storylines at the East Lake Cup, but we'll let Cameron go with his picks and what to watch.
Let's go Virginia on the men's side. I'm a big Bowen Sargent fan. I think that Virginia has a really, really good team again this year. I mean, they bring back so much experience from last year. I think, you know, Ben James is a really interesting character. Obviously, 5 wins as a freshman. He's still been one of the best college golfers the last couple of years, but he's a senior this year. He hasn't quite found that success yet that he was able to have as a freshman. I really think that he has a chance to finish the year strong. It's a really good field. I know we talked about Florida's depth earlier. I think a Florida-Virginia championship match would be really, really fun. On the women's side, I mean, I really liked we talked a little bit about USC earlier, and I know that you mentioned, obviously, they're still without Bailey Shoemaker, who's going to be a really big part of that lineup. But they've had other players step up. Like you said, Sarah Hammett's been really big for them. We talked about Kathy Park, Jasmine Koo, everybody knows about her playing on the Curtis Cup team. So I think USC has a really good chance this field, but watch out for Oregon. They've been just kind of quietly going along and taking care of business this year. They've had a bunch of high finishes. Kiara Romero remains the best player in the world and has been really, really strong, kind of closing in on an LPGA card that could come with a few more top finishes and some amateur events. So I would like maybe old Pac-12 matchup between the now Big Ten teams and USC and Oregon on the women's side.
Lance, are you going to tune into the East Lake Cup on Golf Channel Monday through Wednesday?
Did you say Stanford wasn't playing?
Stanford's not playing, and Oklahoma State is not playing on the men's.
Yeah, I'll probably pass too then.
So Lance, this is your chance.
The mascots coming?
The mascots are not. I miss the mascots. I thought that was the best.
This tournament's also exempt from days, right?
Correct.
County? Yeah.
You don't think they should be?
That's why the teams are coming, Brentley.
Well, I mean, why not? If you don't have to burn days and you can get the great experience, the folks at East Lake and
competition and get some match play experience.
Correct. You earned it. It's a reward for a season well played the previous spring. So I'm pumped. I'm going to be a part of the broadcast.
I'll follow your tweets.
What do you mean you follow my tweets? Oh, you'll follow my tweets
follow
next week?
Yeah, I'll keep up. You'll keep me updated.
Okay. Well, I think USC on the women's side probably has to be the favorite. Suvi Chaivinachathan from Oregon, she was one of those players who advanced through second stage. I believe she will be back, but USC's kind of got a new toy that they're going to see who, you know, what she's made of in match play. We kind of saw it at the NCAA championship, but Elise Lee, the transfer from Northwestern. So we'll see maybe if there's a little bit of a rematch between Elise and her former team. That will probably be in the semifinals, but would be cool to see that in the final. And then I think you got to ride the hot hand with Florida. You have some players who have shown some good match play metal over the last couple of years. Jack Turner made a nice run at the Western Amateur 2 summers ago. Luke Poulter has gotten a lot of match play experience making match play at the USAM and also playing in the Walker Cup. So should be a fun one. That's pretty much all we have for this episode, but we will wind down with kind of this thing that we started this fall. Not kind of, we did start it this fall, but the tournament name of the week. We didn't award one last week because we didn't have a podcast, but I believe someone kind of nominated and awarded it via Twitter. But here are our candidates, and basically, since we have 3, we can actually break ties now, but we will vote on our favorite tournament name of the week. So here are the candidates. We have 7, actually. The Historic Triangle, which is a Division III event hosted by Christopher Newport. There's the Melee, which is hosted, a D3 event hosted by what is listed as Premier College Tournament. So not quite sure what the PCT is. The Cobra Fall Classic, that's another one, a junior college Division II tournament hosted by Parkland. The Lookaway Fall Duel, Delaware Valley's event, D3. Sticking with the food theme, you have the Bojangles Invitational, NAIA, Tennessee, Westland. The Battle of the Expressway, which is a Southern Indiana Division I tournament in Mount Vernon, Indiana. What expressway is that, Lance? You're an Indiana guy.
Yeah, I think that would be Evansville in Southern Indiana, right?
Mount Vernon, Indiana. So what expressway would that be? Would that be
There's expressway around Evansville, or I'm not really sure. That's just what I'm guessing.
So that's got to be. I mean, I'm sure there's not two expressways in Evansville, no. Indiana. And then this one's going to be my vote. But the Marshall Masters, a D3 event hosted by Albion. If you say it fast enough, sounds like Marshall Mathers, but the Marshall Masters. That is my vote for the tournament name of the week. Cameron, any that caught your eye? The Historic Triangle, the Melee, the Cobra Fall Classic, not the Cobra Kai Fall Classic, the Lookaway Fall Duel, Bojangles Invite, Battle of the Expressway, and the Marshall Masters, not the Marshall Mathers.
I think we have the Marshall Masters and the Historic Triangle, like first and last, is kind of the top two. I have to go Historic Triangle. I just think that's an incredible name for a college golf tournament.
Yeah, I would go Historic Triangle too, but tell me, how many teams, was it three teams in the field then?
At the Triangle? Let's see. Well, so
yeah, I'm just wondering.
Wait, but do we think it's an actual triangle? Is it like the Bermuda Triangle? Is it like,
I'm just guessing it seems to me that it would be a long-standing tournament between three teams.
Well, no, there's not three teams. It's the perfect number of teams for a tournament. What number is that, Lance?
Well, probably 12 or 15.
14.
Well, 14 is not the perfect number, Bentley.
Why not?
Stick to you. Well, how do you divide that up?
Play, well, you have seven, some individuals. You get to.
Yeah, well, then that's even no.
Well, so
not the ideal number. I'm not counting that tournament. What about the Fripp Island to Bermuda Invitational? That's a good one.
Yeah, but that, I mean, that's just kind of, if we were giving out literal tournament names of the week, that would be, because it is right. Fripp Island to Bermuda. It's very literal.
Yeah.
It's like, well, saying the Tee It Up Classic, because, you know. It's,
well, I do like the Historical Triangle name. I need to understand what that name means.
Do we think it's the musical instrument? Do you remember the triangle that you played and you hit it with the
who's
thing?
Who's the host of this event?
Christopher Newport.
Huh.
Also in the field, Brody Favorite, Carnegie Mellon.
I don't know. We need to know more about the historical triangle.
Do we think the bumpers were executed at the Historic Triangle? did they fly up on either side of the lane? Which, speaking of bowling, I was at French Lick for the KFT a couple weeks ago, and it was a bowling alley with no digital scoring. You had to do all the scoring by hand.
Do it by hand.
Yeah. It was kind of fun.
Yeah.
Kind of appreciated
There's
that.
There's a lot of people that would fail at that.
but you know what I did not use? I did not use bumpers, and we should not use Brody bumpers in college golf. That is me getting off the soapbox. Totally, total stupidity. And, you know. With that, anything you guys want to add? Thanks for coming on. It was a great great hour just hanging out and kind of around the digital campfire.
Yeah, no, thanks for having us.
Yeah, always fun, Brentley.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank Lance Ringler, Cameron Jordan for jumping on College Golf Talk. We'll be back next week once Berko gets back from the Middle East. We will have an Asia Pacific Amateur Champion crowned. We will have an East Lake Cup Champion crowned, much to the excitement of Lance. And for Lance and Cameron and Berko from afar, this is Brentley. Thanks again for listening to College Golf Talk. We'll see you next week.